Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Last week's show, if you heard it, was about a new book, a novel called In God's House, and the story of the man who wrote it, author Ray Mouton, or Mouton, if you want to pronounce it in American. Mr. Mouton was a successful lawyer in Louisiana's Cajun country who, in 1984, was hired by the Catholic Church to defend the first priest ever to face criminal charges of child molestation. So his attorney assumed, being a loyal, lifelong Catholic, and never having heard anything about such a thing before, he assumed that this was a shakedown and a false accusation. And he quickly found out otherwise, and his life changed forever. His subsequent efforts to save children from pedophile priests and to save the church from itself went on for years and eventually cost him his profession, his family, his health, and his faith in the church. So Ray Mouton has now written a novel based loosely on what he has seen and learned about the clergy sex abuse scandal and all the machinations of the church to try to cover it up, about which we all now know more than we want to know, right? In God's House was published in the UK in fall 2012. It's wonderfully well written, and I'll tell you later how to buy it. Ray Mouton is my guest again today, joining us from France, where he now lives. Welcome, Ray.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Nice to have you on. So you basically found the first crack in the church's armor on this issue, and you really kind of, as I said in the last show, you kicked open the door that had been sealed for so long and let in some light for the first time and let out a huge amount of stink that we've all been aware of ever since, but it basically started to demolish the structure that had protected this whole horrible situation. So if you want to recap, as you did in the last show, but for those who may not have heard it, just briefly recap for us your early involvement.
In August of 1984, I was hired by a diocese to represent the first priest, Father Gilbert Gauthé, who was ever charged with criminal offenses. He was actually one of the worst serial child molesters in the history of the church, as it turned out. And shortly thereafter, I learned there were other priests in that same diocese doing exactly the same thing, and I was summoned to Washington, where I met with Father Tom Dahl and Father Michael Peterson, Peterson being a priest psychiatrist and Dahl being the canonist or canon lawyer in the Vatican Embassy. And the three of us then began a crusade that reached all the way into the Vatican, into the man who would become Pope Benedict, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who was charged with all responsibility and authority for clergy abuse for 24 years before he ascended to the papacy. And in that process, we learned what the world knows today that no one had ever dreamed existed until that time.
Yeah, so you guys, or I guess they already knew it, but you then were the first set of...
No one knew it. No. Tom Dahl had no idea.
Oh, really?
Michael Peterson.
Oh.
No one knew it. This is not the kind of thing that bishops talk to bishops about. I mean, one bishop might know that he has 27 pedophile priests in his diocese, but when he's playing golf or having supper with another bishop in another diocese in the same state or another state, it's not something they discuss over dinner. Each bishop knew what existed in his backyard, but nobody, not Father Tom Dahl, Father Michael Peterson, or anyone else, had any idea that this stretched all across the country, nor did any of us understand at that time that Canada would be devastated by the crisis, as would Ireland, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Austria, Italy, even Switzerland, France, Spain, Peru, Mexico, and there have been scandals in Argentina where the new pope was head of the church. No one understood that in 1984.
Well, I mean, obviously, wherever there are priests, there's a high incidence of this thing. So I would have thought that...
every diocese in the world.
Yeah.
And there's legal evidence that proves that.
Unreal. I would have thought that Michael Peterson, who was, I guess, the head of a psychiatric facility for priests, who a lot of these priests
Michael
were...
Michael did treat priests with sexual dysfunction.
Yeah.
But even Michael had no concept that it was this widespread.
Okay.
And in fact, I'm not sure that priests that were sent from diocese to St. Luke's Institute, if that just wasn't another way of hiding the priest. Now, Michael had a belief that was certainly wrong at the time, that with proper treatment, a pedophile could be rehabilitated. Of course, now we know that that's not true. But at that time, not a great deal was known about pedophiles. Michael had no idea that, for instance, today, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, in writing, would admit that complaints have been made against 6,905 American priests. None of us dreamed that it would go that high. And Reverend Lombardi, who's the spokesman for the Vatican, said 2 years ago that he believed only 5% of Catholic priests abuse children. And if you do the simple math worldwide, he's talking about 40,000 child abusers in the church.
Hmm. All right, so you three musketeers who didn't know each other prior to this, you're a secular attorney, a successful courtroom defense attorney for the most part, and a representative of the Vatican Embassy in Washington and the director of a psychiatric institution for priests. I mean, that's like three strange bedfellows, right? But the three of you got together and decided to try to save the church from itself and to save children from the church. You wrote a report that later came to be called the Mouton Report. Tell us about that whole process and what was in the report.
We met in January of 1985, the weekend of President Reagan's second inauguration. I was in Washington. And from that moment, we were inseparable. We worked 7 days a week. We were mostly on the road going from diocese to diocese because Father Doyle and I wrote, I think it was a 42-page document that Cardinal John Kroll took to the Vatican. He was a very close friend of Pope John Paul II. I think they may have been the only two Polish cardinals prior to John Paul's election. And Kroll went to Washington 3 or 4 or 5 times a year, and he took this document to the Pope. And the Pope listened to him, read it to him, and the Pope then appointed Bishop A. James Quinn in Cleveland through the papal nunciature. It was a secret appointment to monitor this. And the three of us were really, used the right phrase, like the three musketeers. The bond was very, very strong. We were under intense pressure. What we didn't know was that the problem was as immense as it is. For instance, one of our great supporters in the beginning was Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston, who resigned in disgrace for covering up thousands of crimes. The church really didn't want to know what we were finding out, and we didn't understand that.
So I think from, you know, having read the original article and many articles and interviews with you since, I think the scenario was that you guys thought, okay, we're going to write this report to tell the church about something it doesn't know about now. We're going to explain to the church what the situation is and what they should do about it.
That the church didn't, and in some senses that was true. I mean, because there was no central reporting system. You know, one bishop knew about his cases and another one knew about his priest.
Hmm.
And we believed that if we wrote this report and it was delivered, and Cardinal Law was supposed to deliver it to the 400 bishops in the United States at their annual meeting, that if they saw this report, that they would follow our recommendations and they would act responsibly and do something about this. And instead what happened is we were summoned to a secret meeting, and I mean a real secret meeting, at the O'Hare Hilton at the Chicago airport with a man named William Levada, who was then a bishop in California. He vetted every word of this document we wanted presented to the Conference of Bishops, and essentially 2 days later told us to kill the document entirely. Levada's trajectory from there was very interesting. He was appointed an archbishop in Oregon, and then he was appointed archbishop of San Francisco. And he had previously worked with Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who would become Pope Benedict. And when Ratzinger became Benedict, his first appointment was of Levada, and he gave him his prior job. But we put the report together believing that if they read the truth, this 92-page document would convince them to act. Their response was to kill the document. And
so
we didn't. We defied Levada's order. We then mailed it, certified, return receipt requested to every bishop in the United States, and we hand-delivered it to every cardinal in Rome that had anything to do with this issue.
Whew, that was nervy, especially on their part, because you didn't work for the church. These two guys did.
Well, I was already persona non grata. The church hated me. They were attacking me. The press releases that were issued out of Washington about me, they were saying that I was lying about the extent of the scandal. I was trying to extort legal fees from the church.
Hmm.
There absolutely was no scandal involving clergy abuse. And when Tom Dahl and I told the truth to the New York Times in May of 1986, within a week, Tom Doyle was fired from Catholic University, where he was a distinguished law professor, fired from the Vatican Embassy and shipped to Greenland.
Oh, no.
Michael Peterson died.
Put on ice.
Michael got out with death, but Doyle was absolutely brutalized by the church. And at this moment, Tom Doyle has testified in court over 1,500 times on behalf of the truth and victims against the church. He has never, ever stopped the crusade.
So very shortly you realized, gee, we're not in Kansas anymore, and they really don't want to hear this message, and they're going to shoot the messenger if they can. So tell us, what did you recommend in the Mouton Report, as it came to be called?
First, we recommended that they have a policy. They had no policy at all, none, absolutely no policy to deal with this problem, that they take people from different disciplines and point them to a committee and come up with a policy. And secondly, that they have a crisis intervention team, similar to what we were already doing without any authority. Doyle would mail out the short version, the 40-something page document we had. He would mail that out to bishops, and they would call up, and we would go into those dioceses, and I would interface with the lawyer, and Peterson would interface with the local psychiatrist, and Doyle would interface with the head of the tribunal on canon law, that they needed someone to go in and tell them what to do. And the next thing that we requested, and it's clear as bell in that report, is that they not act like the Nixon White House, not develop a siege mentality, that they tell the truth, the whole truth, which they have not done to this day.
What was your prediction as to the financial cost of the church if they didn't address it head-on, as you were recommending they do?
At the time when only $3.5 or $4 million had been paid out, we predicted the cost would be over $1 billion in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much knowledge we had of how big this problem was, though it was submerged. We also predicted that they would lose 1,000 priests. I don't think any of the three of us dreamed that the number would be 6,905 priests by 2013, and the number would be $2.5
billion. You thought it would be a billion. Like the guy said, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money, right?
Yeah, 2.5 times that. I wonder now, as I've wondered for 20 years, but to put it in perspective in today's terms, I really wonder what other institution, organization, or corporation could issue a statement, as the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has, and say, okay, look, our employees who we educated in a process called formation, 7,000 of them have sexually abused children. And their immediate superiors, or bishops, have had knowledge of this and covered up those crimes. And it's cost us and our insurance companies $2.5 billion. I wonder what other organization would remain in business for a day.
Well, it shows the power and the momentum of a huge institution that's gone on for 2,000 years practically. And it takes a lot to turn that Titanic, huh?
Well, I don't think the Titanic's going to turn, but there's documentation that strongly indicates that in Europe, 7 million have left the church since 2005.
Yeah.
And the defections in the U.S. and in Latin America are just as great. The only place where the church is a growth industry today is Africa and the Philippines. They're losing faithful everywhere else. And they have significant cash flow problems right now because all of the money traditionally came out of the U.S., Canada, and Germany. And that came from big, wealthy donors. And they've been turning off the spigot for 4 or 5 years.
In that report back then, where you predicted the cost to the church, did you also predict or project forward to the impact on the church's standing and reputation if they didn't address this problem?
Yes, we did. We said it goes right to the core issue of the church. You know, can a church that claims its moral authority comes from Jesus Christ act in a way that is contrary to the teachings and examples of that life? And if they do, they will forfeit their moral authority.
So you said that the current estimate, I guess, of the number of priests who've been involved in modern times in...
Not an estimate. The Catholic Church in America says in writing, the Conference of Catholic Bishops, that complaints have been made against 6,905.
Is there any way to estimate how many children have been impacted during this whole saga?
Tom Doyle, who is unquestionably the leading authority in the world on the subject, and he's not only worked in the United States, he's worked all over the world, Australia, Germany, Canada, every place this crisis is raging. He's worked with prosecutors. He's worked with plaintiff lawyers. For a long time, Tom Doyle used the figure hundreds of thousands. Today, he's absolutely certain that it's millions. And when he talks about millions, he's talking about over a million child victims. But when he talks about millions with an S, the plural, he's talking about collateral victims. And the collateral victims would be families. Catholic families are large. And if one of the family members has been raped, be it a little girl or a little boy, by a priest, the entire family suffers.
Sure.
And I talk about collateral damage, people like my dad, who went to Mass every day. I wish he hadn't lived to see all of this. The impact on him was incredible when he realized that he had been receiving sacraments from the hands of criminals and from the hands of men who had covered up criminals. He knew all these priests. It was devastating to him.
For a long time, it was hard to believe. It just seems just the opposite of what you'd want to believe. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Ray Mouton. He's the author of a book called In God's House, a novel about one of the great scandals of our time, which is about the Catholic Church clergy sex abuse scandal that we all know way too much about. But back when he first got involved in the story in 1984, essentially no one knew anything about it. And he was the person who sort of turned over the first rock and blew open the story into the public consciousness. And it grew from there. Is this only a modern-day phenomenon, Ray? Is this something that started just in the last lifetime, or has it gone on much longer?
I wish it was a modern phenomenon. In fact, media should refer to this as the current clergy abuse crisis. The first church document evidencing that clergy sex abuse was widespread was issued 7 years before Emperor Constantine recognized the religion. In 313, the document was issued in 306 A.D. in the Council of Elvira, Spain, and it said that any priest who has sex with a boy shall be deprived of communion on his deathbed. In the 4th century, there were very few edicts issued, and they were only issued on important matters, and that certainly means that it was widespread as long ago as 306 A.D., and in every subsequent century, there are church documents relating to clergy sexual abuse, all the way up to the papacy. I mean, there were popes that engaged in sexual acts that you can't even imagine. So, no, it's not anything new. In fact, it's obviously systemic and endemic to the Catholic faith. And what is most hard to understand is that celibacy wasn't adopted until 1139. So for the first 1,000 years of the church, priests were free to marry. Yet, in all of those centuries, there are documents evidencing that it was a huge problem, clergy abuse was. And in the Reformation, 500 years ago, Abbott wrote about clergy abuse. It was one of the reasons the Reformation came about. And today, I think this crisis poses the greatest threat to the oldest, largest, richest, most powerful religious institution on earth since the Protestant Reformation in the last 500 years. And it is a real serious threat to the church.
Sure. Obviously, today, with media and everything, it's much, much greater amplified.
And they don't understand that.
Anything.
They're still operating in a medieval mindset in this modern area. They don't really understand that, for instance, the day that the new pope was elected, a story came out of L.A. that was a $10 million settlement, another $10 million settlement, and the documents revealed that Cardinal Mahoney was told by this priest in 1986 that he had been abusing boys for 7 years, and Mahoney left him in place in the priesthood for 14 more years. And obviously, he abused other boys. That story came out of L.A., and in an instant, it was worldwide. And the Vatican just doesn't understand the world they're living in.
You were a practicing Catholic from a prominent family in Lafayette, Louisiana, who were big supporters of the church, as you said, which is why the Catholic Church hired you. You were very successful as a defense attorney and usually won your cases. So it's safe to say that this book does not come from an atheist or someone who wanted to hurt the church. How do you feel about the church today?
I have absolutely no faith in the Catholic Church. I went too many places. I saw too many things. And I want to say this, too, that my father, who remodeled the cathedral, built the monastery, built a number of churches, built a lot of Catholic schools, went to Mass every day. He saw me interviewed on 60 Minutes in 2002, and the last thing in that interview is I told Ed Bradley that I had absolutely no faith in the church whatsoever. And the phone rang as soon as the broadcast ended, and I looked at caller ID, and it was my dad, who was well into his 80s. And I picked it up with some trepidation because I just said that I didn't believe in this church that was his church. And I said, hello? And my father said, I have never been prouder of you in my life.
Well, that's a sad thing, though. So has the church's approach to addressing this issue evolved and improved over the years? I mean, in your view, do you see it getting better?
Well, I won't even state my view. The view of Catholic columnists and the view of secular columnists and the view of organizations like Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP, the oldest organization in the world, founded in 1989, the universal view is that all the church has done to this day is symbolic things. They've done nothing substantively, and they've issued a lot of pronouncements that have proved to be disingenuous. I don't think it's evolved. I think they've tried to spin it, and you can't PR your way out of this. It's not a PR problem. The only way out for the church, and it's a long, hard road, and they're not going to do it, is to step up and say all bishops and cardinals who have been proven to have covered up crimes are demoted and defrocked or removed from the ministry. Now, in 2002, and this is on the Internet, in bishopsaccountability.org, there was an extensive investigative piece by two journalists, Brooks Edgerton and Reese Dunklin, for the Dallas Morning Herald, where they documented with court records that of the 178 dioceses in the U.S., 108 bishops in 2002 had covered up crimes of priests. The church has to act to remove those men from the ministry, which they will never do, and they need to release all documents in the secret archives of the Vatican and every diocese in the world that relate to clergy abuse. You know, I don't know what you know about the Catholic religion, but it's pretty simple what they tell the faithful they need to do. When they sin, they tell the faithful that they need to first confess the sin, secondly accept their penance, and then they'll be restored to a state of grace. The church set that standard, and they have to meet that standard and clear that bar. They need to confess their sins, and all of their sins are in the secret archives. They need to put that out to the public and the world, and they need to remove the people who are responsible. And, you know, when we talk about responsibility, pedophile actions are rooted in pathology. I mean, it's a very sick person. We know this. But the act of a 65-year-old bishop repeatedly covering up crimes of a man who is raping a 7- and 8-year-old child, those actions are rooted in some sort of pathology, too. Maybe a deeper and darker pathology. I think so. And unless the church actually takes punitive action against those men who are responsible for this crisis and issues all of the documents, I don't think they're going to, quote, return to a state of grace. I just don't think it's going to happen. Their moral authority is going to continue to erode.
I know that Pope Benedict had an early involvement in this whole thing, and even with you directly in your Mouton report, and I don't know if we have time to go into all that, but just very briefly, he recently stepped down, resigned, for the first time in many hundreds of years.
600 years.
Yeah, a very unusual act. And so do you think that the scope of this scandal and its intractability had something to do with his decision to step down?
There's no question about it. There's no question about it. And there's no question either that the current scandal and crisis happened on his watch. In 1981, the spring of 81, he was appointed prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. And that office has all authority and all responsibility for clergy abuse. And for 24 years, he was the guy sweeping it under the rug. There's a great documentary called Mea Maxima Culpa that's out right now involving 200 deaf boys that were abused by one priest in a Catholic school for the deaf. And the priest admitted what he had done to his bishop. And his bishop wrote Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Benedict. He wrote him repeatedly asking him to take action to remove this man from the ministry, and Pope Benedict just ignored the letters.
Well, a new pope was recently elected, Ray. Do you think that Pope Francis will do a better job? Does he seem to have a fundamentally different background and approach to this?
Well, I think he puts a much better face on the church because he has a lot of humility and he has a great love of the poor. But in regard to matters like ordaining women, abolishing celibacy, stem cell research, same-gender unions, he's absolutely aligned with the prior pope. In fact, when Benedict was elected, he was the runner-up in the conclave, and thus the College of Cardinals viewed those guys as interchangeable. And I don't think there's going to be any change in regard to clergy abuse. And if you look at the Washington Post the week of March 17th, you'll find an article about the new pope when he was head of the church in Argentina and clergy abuse scandals that happened there under his watch.
We just have a minute or so left, Ray. What do you see as the outlook for the Catholic Church in general worldwide and, you know, in the U.S. and across the world? You described, you know, briefly earlier where they're kind of targeting, you know, their new the new faithful. But what do you think will happen with the church?
I think the defections are going to continue, but I think they're still going to be the largest organization on earth. The crisis that they're much more concerned about in the Vatican than clergy abuse is the dire shortage of priests worldwide. They're flat running out of priests. In the United States, over half of the priests on active roles are within a few years of retirement age, and there's hardly anybody studying for the priesthood. Ireland was a priest factory traditionally, and last year they ordained one priest.
Wow.
So I think it's going to be a smaller church, a more doctrinaire church, a very right-wing church, a very conservative church. And I don't expect there's going to be any change in regard to clergy abuse.
Sounds like it'll be a smaller church, even though still large.
It's still going to be the largest religious institution on earth. But, you know, they talk about 1.2 billion Catholics. I don't know how many Catholics they are. In Argentina, for instance, two-thirds of the people in the Pope's homeland in polls say they're Catholic, but only 10% say they go to Mass. When you get to defining a Catholic, 1.2 billion people have been baptized as Catholics. They would be counting me as a Catholic because I was baptized as a Catholic.
Yeah.
But I left the church in 1987. You know, my children left the church. You know, I know many people like that. So I really don't know how large the church is in terms of real faithful that pay attention to what the church says or regularly go to Mass.
Let's talk about how to get the book In God's House. You can Google In God's House, put it in quotes if you want to. That makes it easier to find everything. But you'll see lots and lots of stuff. You'll see all kinds of hits on Ray Mouton. And again, the author's name is Mouton. There's a website for the book, raymouton-ingodshouse-thenovel.com. And if you go there, I really urge you to read the author's biography and the author's statement in particular. I'll give you a lot more background on this whole story we've been talking about. You can buy it through Amazon, but it's not yet published in the U.S. The book is big in Europe and in other parts of the world, and it's going to be coming to the U.S. soon. But you can still get it through Amazon.com. It's available as a Kindle for just a buck and a half. Or if you want to order a copy, go to Amazon U.S. and select books, enter In God's House, and then follow the link to these sellers. And you'll see a lot of them in the U.K. But don't be, you know, put off by that. You can order the book In God's House from those booksellers. The one I used for my copy was The Book Depository. And the total cost, including shipping, was about $27. You know, it's really just a few dollars for shipping, oddly enough, and it gets to you in about 10 days. So it's not hard to get. There are plenty of copies available in England and will be before too long in the U.S. Ray, I thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been fascinating. Quite a story.
Thank you very much, Cord.
Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.